Welcome. It's a great pleasure to see all of you here. And it's an honor and a privilege to introduce our speaker this evening, Helen Clark. I'm delighted to say that she's not a newcomer to the LSE. This is the fourth time she's spoken here, given a public lecture, twice as Prime Minister of New Zealand and once before in her current role as head of the United Nations Development Programme. Born on a farm, Helen Clark became politically active as a teenager in protests against the Vietnam War, and soon after joined the Labour Party, and then whilst studying and then lecturing at the University of Auckland. She was first elected to Parliament in 1981, and it was in 1999 that she was elected the 37th Prime Minister of New Zealand and the first woman Prime Minister to be elected at a general election. She served three consecutive terms for a period of almost 10 years, and during that tenure did not shy from tackling some of the key challenges. Her government implemented a number of major economic initiatives, including the Kiwi Bank, the New Zealand Superannuation Fund, the New Zealand Emissions Trading Scheme. Also important work focusing on supporting families, introducing paternity leave, introducing a steadily increasing minimum wage, but also an international agenda which promoted democracy and human rights, but also encouraged free trade. And under her leadership, New Zealand was the first developed nation to sign a free trade agreement with China. In 2009, she was appointed the head of the United Nations Development Programme, the third highest UN position, and now is also the chair of the United Nations Development Group, a committee which consists of the heads of all UN funds, programs, and departments working on development. As you would expect from that portfolio, she has broad-ranging interests and responsibilities, but certainly from the perspective of the International Growth Center, which I'm saying is privileged to host this evening's lecture, particularly interesting, I think, for us are the focus that she's brought to South-South interaction, to the ability of developing countries to learn from each other, and the importance of building on that as a key to development, but also focusing on other areas, the importance of innovation and entrepreneurship, again, another theme that is very important to the IGC, and also in terms of trade, continually thinking about how countries can grow through trade and how now the South is actually becoming a dominant economic force in the world economy. Let me just close by saying that in 2013, she was ranked the 21st most powerful woman in the world, which probably understates her influence. So it's a great privilege to introduce Helen Clark.
Thank you very much, Professor Leap, and good evening, everyone. Both present in the lecture theatre and virtually, because I've been seeing it advertised as a live webcast as well. And thank you to the LSE and to the International Growth Centre for hosting me. And can I also acknowledge at the outset the role the International Growth Centre is playing in providing independent and research-based advice to so many developing country governments on economic growth. The topic I've set for today is around the next global development agenda, from aspiration to delivery. A discussion on this is well underway in international circles with a view to defining what will succeed the end of the MDG time period at the end of 2015. And let me say from the outset that the signs are that this agenda can be bolder than the MDGs were. Responding to challenges faced by developed and developing countries alike, it will be a sustainable development agenda with poverty eradication as a central imperative. The MDG agenda largely set targets for developing countries to meet. There was the partnership goal, which outlined measures which would support development from better trade rules to debt relief to access to essential drugs. But a sustainable development goals agenda is being conceived of as more transformational, encouraging transitions to sustainable economies and societies by all, and supporting developing countries to make the transition. So how realistic is an ambition like this? Well, already the UN's member states have agreed, and I quote, that the agenda should have a single framework and set of goals, universal in nature and applicable to all countries, while taking account of differing national circumstances and respecting national policies. And very importantly, and I'll keep coming back to this theme, it was agreed that the agenda should promote peace and security, democratic governance, the rule of law, gender equality, and human rights for all. Those are the precise words of the outcome document from the leader level meeting at the UN General Assembly last September on MDGs and post-2015. So that's expressing a very high level of ambition. The world would be a better place if these aspirations could be delivered on. Are member states likely to agree on that? What would it take to achieve it? What are the world's people saying about it? What stands in the way of meeting such aspirations? That's some of the territory that I want to canvass in the lecture tonight. So, first to start with, what do I see as the big global challenges to sustainable development, which a new agenda should try to have some impact on? And those big global challenges encompass but go well beyond the major environmental challenges. And let's start up front with the persistently high levels of income inequality, inequality of opportunity, and other non-income disparities, alongside still a significant number of people living in extreme poverty. Equality was highlighted as a fundamental value in the UN Millennium Declaration in 2000. The outcome of the leader's statement at that event, which I was at the Millennium Summit, stated that in addition to our separate responsibilities to our individual societies, we have a collective responsibility to uphold the principles of human dignity, equality, and equity at the global level. And yet, in so many places, we don't see a lot of progress in combating inequality in its various forms. Global income inequality stands at a very high level, with around 8% of the world's people earning half the world's income, with the remaining 92% sharing the rest. And that maldistribution is rightly seen by civil society advocates worldwide as unacceptably high. The impact of high income inequality in itself can impede long-term growth, is associated with poorer health outcomes, can generate political instability, contribute to higher rates of violence, erode social cohesion. It has many impacts. And when one combines economic exclusion with political exclusion, the inability to have an impact with decision makers, this can be quite a toxic mix, as rather a range of uprisings in recent times might suggest. Beyond income inequality, we see gender-related discrimination, inequalities related to geography, ethnicity, religion, age, disability, to name just a few factors plaguing a wide range of countries. So I have no doubt in my mind that inequality is a significant global issue that the world as a whole has a stake in tackling. Second major issue I would identify is the jobs crisis. The ILO estimates that more than 34 million workers lost their jobs with the onset of the global recession of 2008, and an additional 185 million workers joined the ranks of the working poor, subsisting on under $2 a day. The number of unemployed worldwide was projected to rise by another 5.1 million last year, another 3 million this year, and crucially, some 600 million more jobs would be needed over the next decade and a half or so just to keep unemployment levels where they are at the moment, which is rather high. Third major shared challenge is around the environmental degradation issues, including to the climate ecosystems and the disasters associated with this. And with what's happening with the climate, we're looking at rather a grim picture unless there's concerted global action. Of course, the cost of action is high, but as Lord Stern and others have been pointing out for some time, the cost of inaction is even higher. Natural disasters, many of which, not all of course, but many are climate related, are estimated already this century to have cost around $2.5 trillion, and the poorest people in countries suffer the most. Fourth shared challenge I'd identify is around war and conflict. The terrible events in the Central African Republic and South Sudan in recent weeks demonstrate yet again how devastating war and conflict are for development. Then there's the ongoing tragedy in Syria, which was calculated last year to have lost some 35 years of human development progress since the conflict began. And these crises don't neatly stay within national borders. They have a way of spilling over into sub-regions, as we see with Syria, the big impact on the small countries of Jordan and Lebanon in particular. We see the destabilisation in the Sahel following Libya's upheaval. The World Bank is estimating that more than 1.5 billion people live in countries affected by armed conflict and fragility, but the ripple effects of that can go out far, far beyond the immediate country or indeed the immediate neighbourhood. And increasingly, also, we see scarce resources for development so often diverted into humanitarian relief because people need food, water, shelter, medicine. In the years that I was Prime Minister in New Zealand, one could see an increasing amount of our small ODA going to the complex emergencies to respond to crises caused by war and conflict and, of course, the natural disasters. And I'd also add to shared challenges and impacts on development the cost of crime and citizen insecurity in a range of countries. Most stark in Latin America and the Caribbean. UNDP has recently released a major report on crime and citizen security in that region, advocating for more comprehensive and developmental approaches because we don't see the narrowly law enforcement-focused policies having a significant impact, and we think a more developmental approach needs to be taken. So, altogether, these big challenges facing us as a global community appear to call for a shift in the way we think about and do development, to endeavour to bring economic and social progress together with environmental sustainability, and specifically address the role of peace and security, rule of law, democratic governance, gender equality, human rights, all those issues identified in the leaders' statement out of New York last September. It will also provoke debate around who needs to engage on this new agenda, and it will need engagement from both the world's north and south. The absolute size of the emerging economies and their populations and the interconnectedness and universal nature of global challenges mean that we're not talking about a burden to be carried financially by Western ODA. We're looking for much more comprehensive pathways and supports for development. So to come to the global conversation which has been going on, this is another way in which the process leading up to what will be sustainable development goals is different. The MDGs largely derive from the Millennium Declaration of 2000, and that was intergovernmentally negotiated. But the actual targets and indicators of the MDGs were determined by a relatively small group of insiders. And this, if you like, elite process may explain in part why the MDGs took some time to get traction. Now, it's not surprising that when the Overseas Development Institute and New York University had a look at what makes international agreements work and get traction last year, they concluded that if you bring a wide range of actors into the process, including civil society groups, then you're more likely to get an agenda, get traction, and move fairly quickly. And insights like that were precisely why the UN Development System set out to initiate a very large global conversation on what the world's people might want from a post-2015 agenda, to make it more than just something that was negotiated by member states without regard to global opinion. And the outreach of this consultation is estimated to have gone to rather more than 1.7 million people now. Across basically all the world's countries, there were a great many national consultations, close to 90. Consultations on major themes, which were done virtually through a series of regional and global meetings. And then this big My World survey, which invited people to engage on what their priorities were. And it wasn't only available online, because clearly that in itself has a bias to who can get online. There was a huge effort in the consultations to reach out to the most marginalised and excluded groups and ensure that voices could be heard. So what did we hear from this vast global consultation? And there's a very good report on it, the 1 Million Voices report released last September. Well, big first message, do not give up on the MDGs. If you're transitioning to a bigger, bolder agenda, don't forget that a number of the MDGs have not been achieved either at a global level or by a range of countries on a range of targets. And eradicating poverty and hunger, gender equality, improving health and education, these remain very, very high in people's priorities. And they want these issues to be addressed directly. But interesting that people also focused on the quality of what was being achieved and delivered, and said, for example, it's not enough just to say that most children in the world are in school. Are they learning anything? And I think there is a case for saying that as access has expanded very rapidly, quality hasn't. And so some of the reports one sees about how much command of basic reading, comprehension, numeracy children have after some years of education and very overcrowded classrooms with few resources, there's not a lot to show for it. So focus on quality in education as well as across other areas targeted is seen as being rather important. Second major message was around inequalities. Really a cry from the heart from groups who feel rather excluded from the progress made globally or in their own countries. The disabilities constituency, very, very vocal on this, saying if you measure things by averages, percentages, often we're the ones who are missing out, but we're not showing up in these statistics. And there's a going alongside that great desire for visibility is better information and data, so it can be clearer who's not getting there in the progress a country's making, and so then they can be part of designing the measures and solutions which might reach them. So very strong equalities focus. The message around gender equality and empowerment was coming through clearly as well. A third point, prioritising decent work and adequate livelihoods. Now, in all honesty, this wasn't a huge focus of the MDGs. It's a sub-goal in MDG 1. But so many people in these consultations report that inadequate income, really bad jobs, where you take a job, any job, because you have to earn the money, but it's unsafe, it's got no dignity. There was a lot of feedback on that and the need to include decent work as a core objective of the new framework. Interestingly, what came through strongly in the global survey was a desire for better governance. People are really quite fed up with their governments globally. In rich and poor countries, I observed in a lecture in Sydney late last year that you see in Western countries, new governments elected, and they're unpopular almost from the day they take office. It's almost as if the problems are too big, and maybe parties don't confront them openly in election campaigns. Expectations are high, they're quickly dashed. From many countries, there's a feeling that their governments are corrupt, they don't respond to them, they're not effective, they can't deliver services, they don't allocate resources fairly. This priority for better governance, honest and effective governance, ranked fourth in the global survey of all the priorities. So I think there's a message for governments and aspiring governments in that. A clear message about the need for a more transformational and universal agenda. So while often advocates of this or that act in silos, you know, people advocate for the environment, they advocate for poverty eradication, they advocate for health, not the way people see it. They have a more joined-up view that if my local ecosystem's being destroyed, then that's going to impact on my subsistence livelihood. I want more joined-up approaches around poverty, environment, society. I think that's an important message. And the final one I'd pick out was the call for what we're calling an accountability revolution. People want to know that if there's a global agenda and people have signed up to it, that they will honour the commitments that they make. And from the consultation, expectations have been raised. Global public wants to continue to be engaged in the debate about what the priorities are, wants to be able to monitor the progress that's being made and hold their governments accountable for results. And as I'll say a bit later, there's also an issue of who else should be held accountable for results, because there's many other actors in development apart from states and governments. So we brought all of this together in the Million Voices report for the UN and released it in September. And I was quite encouraged that in the negotiated outcome statement from the leaders' meeting, they emphasised, and I quote, that our deliberations have taken account of the voices of people worldwide and the concerns and priorities they conveyed. Now, we see it as our job in the UN development system to keep being a channel to ensure that the views of civil society are coming through to the member states, because the process, as I'll explain soon, has gone into a member state process. But I think that the doors have been opened on the design of the Sustainable Development Goals, and they can't now be closed. There's an eagerness and a hunger to be involved by civil society globally. I should also mention that the high-level panel report, which Prime Minister David Cameron was a co-chair of, has been quite a useful and influential report. They advocated for an agenda which would leave no one behind, put sustainable development at the core of the new agenda, transform economies to provide jobs and inclusive growth, build peace and effective, open and accountable public institutions, and forge new and wide-ranging partnerships for development. So there's some consistencies in where that panel was going with where the member states agreed to go in September. So, as I said, we're now in a phase where the General Assembly of the United Nations has a working group, and it is meeting to formulate proposals about post-2015 and goals and targets. Whether it will report specifically on goals and targets or do something more discursive is still to be determined by them. But there is a very serious effort going on where this working group, on which the United Kingdom is represented, is taking major briefings from the UN system and beyond on these big issues that should form part of the new agenda. And there's also an expert group on financing for sustainable development meeting as well. These groups will report in September, and the Secretary General will also produce a report trying to synthesise all the many inputs to the design of goals and targets, and then the member states will start negotiating. And meanwhile, as I say, we see our job in the UN development system to continue to be a channel for civil society to get views through to the member states. And we're starting some work with a number of governments to test how targets and indicators might be developed, particularly in some of the areas which weren't covered by MDGs, like governance. If it's agreed that, you know, governance should be an issue focused on, then how would you start to formulate some of the goals around that? So, in tackling the big challenges, where do I think the new agenda should prioritise action? Well, firstly, leaving no one behind has a lot of traction. Some call it the getting to zero agenda, you know, eradicating extreme poverty by 2030, eradicating hunger, ending avoidable child deaths, extending access to services like health to give universal cover. There's a lot of traction in the leaving no one behind agenda. But I think it's important to underline that this becomes idle rhetoric unless you factor in that achieving that requires achieving it in South Sudan, Central African Republic, Afghanistan, Mali, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, and a range of countries which are presently weighed down by war and conflict, which causes de-development, not development. And as the major populous emerging economies are lifting so many hundreds of millions of their people out of poverty, increasingly the focus of extreme poverty is going to shift to the most fragile states. And, you know, if we are ambitious and want to eradicate poverty, then we need to be looking at what are going to be the long-term drivers of development in countries which are presently struggling. So we can't eradicate unless we're addressing the drivers there. And then I think one goes back to looking at what are the fundamental pillars of development: peace and stability, reconciliation, national dialogue, the role of the rule of law, social cohesion, better governance, economic and environmental sustainability. And these areas, you know, sometimes can be left at the margins while economic growth and service delivery are focused on. If, for example, one looks at the debate which has been raging now about what lay underneath the upheaval in South Sudan from mid-December, there's a lot of commentary on the huge donor support which went in to establish the new state of South Sudan. But almost certainly insufficient attention was paid to the need to address the legacy of conflict in the country. And it wasn't just south-north conflict. Perhaps that was, you know, the basic failure to recognise that was important. There was a legacy of conflict to be addressed and a need to build cohesion from the community level up in order to build a nation. And I think going forward, and hoping that there will be a ceasefire agreed because people have suffered a great deal in the past month, I think all the development actors will need to look at how to step up support for grassroots-led processes of healing, reconciliation and recovery, which are going to need to accompany any political process which is agreed on if peace is to last. And one could make probably similar points about Central African Republic. So the leaving no one behind agenda is important, but, you know, hard to achieve unless we can work out how to support countries to deal with legacy of war and conflict. But tackling inequalities, my second point, is a much broader agenda than just leaving no one behind, because leaving no one behind tends to say, well, here's a level under which you will not fall, but it's not addressing the gaps above that level. And we've seen many types of inequalities increasing, including where economic growth and poverty reduction have been rapid. And you're an informed audience, so you know of the many examples where, yes, poverty has reduced, but inequality has increased. And I do not think that the inequalities issue can be satisfactorily addressed only by social policies which are endeavouring to mitigate effects. I think it's going to need much smarter, inclusive, job-rich growth models, along with fairer sets of rules at the global level in a range of areas from trade to finance to how we deal with the climate change challenge. And in these ways, the ambitions which the Sustainable Development Goals may express are linked to progress being made in other multilateral fora, which is, of course, very slow, whether we're talking of the WTO or the climate talks or other things. But it will be critical to try to develop a more people-centred globalisation than we've seen in the trends in globalisation to date. And the third area where I really think the agenda has to go is in a joined-up sustainable development agenda, which promotes economic and social progress without wrecking the ecosystems we all depend on. So environmental sustainability has to be one of the cornerstones of the new agenda and integrated throughout it. Now, this too is a challenge because we are looking at a world by 2050 where adequate energy, food, water needs to be provided for another 2.4 billion people. Trying to provide universal access to energy at a time where just building a whole lot more coal-fired power stations will have an impact on the environmental sustainability. So how to push forward the three strands of sustainable development where we lift human development, living standards, social equality, while we're trying to maintain ecosystem balance is going to require very smart and joined up approaches. At UNDP, we advocate for triple win policies to support countries to develop strategies which will touch all three buttons. And when one sees Ethiopia, a least developed country, emerge with a green economy strategy which is low carbon and climate resilient in its aspirations, you think if Ethiopia, with all the challenges it has had, can think this way, surely this is inspirational for the rest of us. And we see, you know, other countries really trying very hard to try to put these three things together. Yes, we want human development, more of it, please, but we need to do it in a way which isn't going to limit the prospects of future generations. And I think post 2015 we need to be thinking in more joined up ways about funding sustainable development and the climate financing agenda. At the moment these are quite separate silos. Now of course the rhetoric around climate finance has always been that it should be additional and predictable. But the truth is there's not a cent of climate finance which would go to developing countries which isn't going to contribute to sustainable development. Adaptation to climate change is the other side of the coin from building resilience to disaster, major climatic events. Mitigation is about, you know, a clean, sustainable energy and other sector pathway forward. So at some point, we need to be taking an overview of what are the different pots of money available for development. Where will the role of climate finance be in that? And think rather more holistically about the funding. Now, just a very small number of key points about pushing this agenda forward. Target setting. The MDGs were time-bound, few in number, measurable, easier to communicate, which were good characteristics. But the targets weren't always a good mix with the national or the local context because they were established as global targets and on the basis of global trends. And probably going into the MDG period in 2001, some developing countries may have already met all of the goals. Others had met none and still have met none. So to be most relevant, the thinking is that targets need to be localised to reflect what can be achieved, which may be more or less than an indicative global target which is set. And again, this thinking was coming through the high-level panel report, which advocated for universal goals, but with quite a lot of target setting at the national and local level. And in the member state discussion now, that's also a theme. But at UNDP, we do think that maintaining global targets will be important because one wants to work for the ambitions of individual countries to add up to achieving the shared global goal. And, of course, you want to be able to compare progress relative country to country as well. So there will be a mix of the global goal and aspiration and target, but then countries picking from a menu as to what's most relevant to them and localising it to context. Then there's the point about partnerships and mutual accountability. Sustainable development agenda is going to need very, very big partnerships, and they will be partnerships running across governments and the whole range of non-state actors, civil society, NGOs, academia, private sector. all these actors are needed to make a global agenda move. And one of the issues will be, should an accountability framework go beyond the usual suspects, governments, to include the non-state actors? The high-level panel argued that as the number and importance of the non-state development actors grows, including them in accountability frameworks will be important. And so if one's thinking of the private sector, what's it prepared to commit to? Is it prepared to commit to codes of behaviour, ethics, transparent and green accounting practices, whatever? What is the accountability framework for the non-state actors? For the member states, I think the discussion around common but differentiated responsibility will be a very interesting one. Developing countries, particularly the poorest, will look for commitment from developed countries like Britain, New Zealand, to provide bedrock public financing for sustainable development, which would be used in a catalytic way to grow and attract other sources of financing. So that does mean reliable and sufficient levels of official development assistance, along with specific funding to enable poor countries to deal with the pressing global and developmental challenges like climate change. At some point, as I say, this means taking an overview of all the funding streams, with climate finance being looked at in this overall picture. Developing countries in the agenda could commit to implement and fund according to their abilities transitions to sustainable development, raising and allocating the resources they have, but with funding support for the poorer countries, as I just suggested, and perhaps with middle-income countries also assuming more of the share of the burden for tackling the global challenges. But all developing countries will want to see very firm commitments from the global north on technology transfer, knowledge sharing, and capacity building. And the developed north will need to show that it's prepared to lead the way in adopting more sustainable production and consumption patterns. So, to conclude, this new global agenda matters because it will be setting the global development priorities for the next 15 years or so. I, as one always inclined to see the glass more than half full, do think that, broadly speaking, the progress against the MDG goals and targets has been encouraging. I would not want to assume cause and effect between target setting and benchmarks being reached. But I think with respect to areas of the MDGs like health, the evidence is that the rate of decline and the burden of disease in the areas targeted has been faster than it would have been had there not been MDGs galvanising action, attention, resources into these specified areas. So global goal setting does help focus, channel, get action in important areas. So it does matter what goes into the agenda and into the SDGs in these next 15 years, years when we would really like to see decisive breakthroughs on poverty eradication, hunger eradication, greater equality, and ensuring that we can live within nature's boundaries while we endeavour to lift human development for all. I guess my final message is to people engaged in all of this at the citizen and civil society level is stay engaged. Member states need to hear from their citizens on post-2015. And as I've emphasised at UNDP and in the sister organisations, UNICEF, WHO, the wide range and the family of the UN, we continue to advocate for the voices of the global public to be heard and for a big and bold agenda. But your voices, voices of civil society in Britain and this country and other countries, need to be heard. And all governments, as they go into the intergovernmental negotiations, need to know that civil society is watching, does want accountability, does want engagement, and that we're in an era where making decisions behind closed doors doesn't wash with the global public. The global public wants engagement, it wants accountability, And I hope the UN can continue to open itself up in this way to make that possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a stimulating and wide-ranging talk, which I think really sets us up now for questions and discussion. Let me just begin by saying the event is being recorded and will be made available online, subject to there being no technical difficulties. It's also being streamed online, so we're very pleased to have a much broader audience for the event than just those in this room. Finally, we do have a Twitter hashtag, which is #LSCUNDP, if you'd like to contribute in that way. I'm happy now to take questions, and I'll do that three at a time so that the speaker then has a chance to respond to all of them together. So first, right here in the center. Please wait for a microphone, which will come to you from one of the stewards.
We have been looking at short-term gains, and not enough attention has not been paid into the long-term effects. One thing, the corruption in the southern hemisphere is not taken into any equation very much. And the long-term detrimental effects of tourism is not at all given any attention at all. And you spoke about governance, and how do you expect UN officials in countries with horrible governance do or behave? Because I can give you a lot of things about Sri Lanka, where the UN officials have been struggling, and there are even now currently a lot of bad things happening. How do you get on? Thank you very much.
Thank you. At the very back.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. My question is a follow-on to the previous lady's question, and it's about the internal governance of the UN, particularly in the example you gave of South Sudan, where certain things perhaps weren't done in depth and the response may have had some difficulties. How capable is UNDP of joining things up? That question is based on observations from a very helpful German diplomat when I was working on a UNDP administered but not managed project, where he said, why on earth are the UNDP involved? Secondly, a comment at Chatham House last year by a speaker on Somalia, where he said that the UN, I don't know if he said UNDP, he said the UN was the biggest problem to joined up cooperation in Somalia. It was part of the problem, not the solution. And a comment made by a colleague of mine who had worked on a UN-managed mission in Bosnia and alleged that he was with the UN head of administration when word came in that two staff members had been injured when their vehicle had struck a landmine. And he said he was very shocked to note that allegedly the administration asked whether they had a travel authorization, which would have meant that the UN would have been responsible for payments to, injury and so on. He felt that the first question had been how badly hurt they were. Both died of their injuries. Is there something wrong internally with some people and some structures in the UN?
Thank you. Could I just ask future speakers please to keep it short, because I do want to give as many people as possible a chance to ask questions, and that won't happen if people ask long questions. Yes, one final question here for this group. Sorry, this person in the center in the... And if I could ask us one other thing, if you could identify yourself, any questions as you begin.
Thank you very much. My name is David Rinnert. I'm a Master of Public Administration student here at the LSE. My question is going into a similar direction. You've been talking in detail about the objectives of the development agenda, but what is your take on the means? What are the approaches in general, the policies that the development aid actors should take in light of the failures of a lot of approaches in the past decades, such as capacity building problems and so on and so forth? Thank you very much.
Well, with respect to the first question, the corruption issue, which came through very, very strongly in the global consultations, if there is to be a goal established around governance, I would think corruption would probably be one of the focuses of that. It is debilitating. It happens to be in our mandate to deal with issues of governance, support countries with better institutional arrangements, ethics, values, but also increasingly a stress on the role of citizen engagement, monitoring the media, civil society, and in being the spotlight on corruption as well. Easier said than done, I know, in a range of countries. But if governance is to be a focus of the agenda, I think corruption would stand out as something that needs some attention. Secondly, on the UN development system making itself fit for purpose for a sustainable development agenda, I think sustainable development will require even more attention to joining up agency efforts. Now, the UN has as many arms as you know, but at the country level, there are country teams. And traditionally, the approach was quite sinoized. WHO worked with the health department, somebody else worked with this department or that department. But when you're thinking sustainable development, it requires integrated policy approaches, being able to bring sectors, departments, interests together. And for the UN, it also means joining up the range of skills and expertise it has to support that kind of approach by governments. So all the attention that countries like the United Kingdom have given to the delivering as one approach for the UN development system really needs to be continued as we move into this sustainable development area. And on the last issue around strategies, I think this focus on economies which generate inclusive growth and jobs is needing to be very, very central. Development, I suppose, goes through fads and fashions. The MDGs had a very big focus on social goals, and they're very important social goals. But for the near medium term, to roll out satisfactory levels of education, healthcare, infrastructure, social protection, services generally in a country, this can't be done by, in effect, charitable support. You need the kind of inclusive growth in an economy which will see people employed, revenue generated for governments to mobilise the resources to carry these causes forward in a country. So I think focusing on inclusive growth, job-rich growth, livelihoods, incomes will be important. And then in the countries affected by conflict and fragility, I think, not sort of rushing to a kind of second generation of issues before some of these early recovery, healing, reconciliation, dealing with legacy of conflict, what will bring the society together. I think there needs to be more reflection on what will be effective in those areas. And there's going to be a lot of that needing to be done in the two countries I mentioned, which are suffering so badly in landlocked central North Africa at the moment.
More questions? One from
Sorry, do you mind passing it down that way?
Seems to be okay. Kia ora and haere mai to the LSE. My name is Erin. I'm a New Zealander and a postgraduate student here. My question is, how significant a role do you think small developed countries like New Zealand can play in driving the global development agenda?
Kia ora also. I'm a New Zealander, Robert Wade. Helen, I wanted to ask you if you could say something about the funding, the resources to the UN system for not only leading the transition from the Millennium Development Goals into the Sustainable Development Goals, but also for actively helping to carry them out. My understanding is that there's something of a crisis. If not a crisis, then at least many Western states are very much constraining their financial contributions to the UN. The US, the UK have basically walked out of UNIDO, for example. They are trying to, in the organizations they still support, they're trying to, in a sense, bilateralize their contributions so that they exercise national influence over the, how the agencies use their money. And in general, there's a kind of decay of a multilateral spirit reflected in cuts in financial contributions. Well, if all that is true, then there's the question of whether what you're talking about is kind of rhetoric in the sky, which is not actually able to be carried out because of this cutback, especially from Western states to the UN system.
Hi, Samantha Attridge from the Commonwealth Secretariat. A question for Helen. It's related to the last question, and that's really about how serious the international community is about a global partnership for development, which needs to be renewed and strengthened in the post-2015 environment, and pick it up on the financing issue, but also issues around global governance, economic governance, where developing countries don't participate in fora such as the G20, for example. Mm-hmm. But my second point, I think, I'm really interested to understand this issue about convergence with SDGs and MDGs, and in particular, I think it's complicated when you include climate change in that, because they're my understanding is that countries are very wary of renegotiating climate change and climate finance in an SDG-MDG context when it's subject to UNFCCC negotiations. So how does climate finance actually realistically fit into post-2015 if we're going to have a holistic framework?
Mm. Right. Three questions. Firstly, what can the role of small developed countries like New Zealand be? Well, you know, New Zealand's a country of, 4.4 million people. So even if it had achieved the 0.7% target, it's not going to be of world-shattering dimensions. But nonetheless, what small countries do has a positive impact. Their voice counts. They can advocate for things which will move in the right direction. So, we see small countries like Norway, like Denmark, like Finland, like Sweden, really having a very significant impact on global debate. They do pay up, and they're listened to because they're seen as extremely committed. So I wouldn't think of a small size needing to inhibit a country's ambition to have impact. Secondly, to Robert's question, funding for the multilateral system. Firstly, I should say that for UNDP, we have had our funding sustained from the United Kingdom, and are very, very grateful for that. But there is certainly a trend away from core funding for the UN agencies towards more tagged funding. And the issue then becomes, what about the quality of the non-core funding? Because there's non-core and non-core, so if it goes into larger thematic funds, that can still enable you to be quite strategic in the way you deploy and prioritise resources. But would be unfortunate if there's more of a trend towards really making the UN a contract organisation, because that does detract from the multilateral character, the ability to carry out the mandates that are given by the General Assembly and our governing bodies. So some agencies have been quite badly affected by the funding trends. When I came to UNDP already, the core funding was barely a fifth of the total amount of funding. But quality non-core, and also broadening the base of funding where, increasingly needing to have, quite intense conversations with the middle-income countries about them funding more of what we do in-country, because donor countries are very much focused on the poorest and most fragile countries, and yet there are a great range of development needs that our middle-income country partners are identifying that they want support with. So just finding a way to navigate through these funding streams, it can be challenging. But
what is the response of the middle-income countries?
Quite positive. Sometimes the conversation can take a while because countries have been used to having more donor funding, for example. Let's take Vietnam, which has moved to lower middle-income status. And the donors have long been very supportive of Vietnam, but they're starting to signal that they see Vietnam more as a trade and investment partner rather than a recipient of development assistance. So the conversation we're starting to have with Vietnam, which is still specifying many things that it wants the UN to support it to deal with, how will we finance that? What contribution can Vietnam make to that? Vietnam is a good example of a country where the UN effort is quite well joined up. It was the sort of most advanced and the pilots of delivering as one, so it's a good place to be having that conversation. But I could instance quite a range of developing countries where most, if not all, of our program is being paid for by the country concerned because it values the distinct attributes that we bring to their development discourse and thinking. And thirdly, on the global partnerships, how real are they? And the global governance issues. I mean, there are big global governance issues where representation, obviously, in key institutions is still quite inequitable. The IMF has yet to be able to implement its quota reform agreed in 2010, and due to be going into another round. But again, if one looked quite objectively at the composition of governing boards of our own programs, they're very much weighted towards donor countries, I guess on the basis that he or she who paid the piper called the tune. But again, countries are starting to say, well, don't we need a broader representation in a number of the multilateral bodies? On the issue of where does climate come into the SDGs, well, you can't ignore it, because one of the major planetary boundaries we're perilously close to exceeding is in climate. And yes, there is this other process going on, slow and laborious as it is. But climate finance, is going to be so important to developing countries. And the other side of the coin of adaptation and mitigation, as I say, very clearly defined sustainable development objectives, building resilience, cleaner energy paths, and so on. So it can't be ignored. I think the point that's important to make is the sustainable development goals being negotiated are not a treaty. It's an intergovernmental agreement, consensus that has to be reached. It's not legally binding. It should have moral force, and that's where all these issues of accountability, citizen monitoring, citizen engagement are so important. But the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiations should be able to deliver a binding global agreement that says who is accountable for doing what, who is legally bound to do what. And that is due to come to a head when the French host the climate summit in 2015, the very year that a new sustainable development agenda should be agreed on. So it's a big year next year. It's also a year when another critical framework for development is due to be renewed, and that doesn't get so much attention. But that is the Hyogo decade for disaster reduction comes to an end. Now, disaster reduction is resilience, is adaptation, is being able to have systemic resilience to the natural disaster shocks that come along. There will be a major international conference in Sendai in northeastern Japan to renew that agenda. And that, too, needs to be linked in with this broader development agenda. And there's been a lot of discussion around how to mainstream disaster risk reduction and resilience into the new agenda.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very sorry to say that I know a number of you still had questions and we've run out of time. But I'd ask you first to remain seated for a few minutes to allow the speaker to leave because she is going on to another meeting. And finally, just to join me in thanking her.